Okay, our third case this afternoon is number 13-1527, Western Gecko LLC v. ION Geophysical. Mr. Healy.
Your Honor, may it please the Court. My name is David Healy and I represent ION Geophysical, the appellant. 2.5 years ago, we raised the problem that Western Gecko did not have an assignment or other ownership of these patents. We filed motions in the district court after going back and forth with them for several weeks. We filed a motion in this court. They control all the evidence. Dr. Biddleston still works for, whether it's Western Gecko or an affiliated company. They have the documents. They have everything. And yet in 2.5 years, they've come up with nothing. There's one written assignment for each inventor. That written assignment is to Schlumberger Technology Corporation. That written assignment is filed in the Patent Office records and is entitled to a presumption that that is the assignment that controls. And that assignment shows that this plaintiff had no authority and no standing and no jurisdiction in the court to pursue claims on the three Biddleston patents, which are really what the fight's about. That's where all the money is. That's the lost profits is entirely in the Biddleston patents, and even the bulk of the reasonable royalty are in the Biddleston patents. And so as a practical matter, that's really where we are in terms of the relief that's needed for my client. And as a practical matter, if they had evidence that they were the assignee, that they owned this patent, it would have come out in the last 2.5 years since we first raised it.
Well, I mean, there is a chain of title that they argue for that the would give them the patent. Right?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think your opinions in the Fine Solutions case versus Nuvasiv, as well as your opinion Monday in the Warsaw orthopedics case, bring up an important point here, and that is you can't just mush together corporate entities. In Warsaw Pact, we saw these corporate entities had carefully structured relationships that included various motivations. In Spine Solutions, they were just mushed together. And in both cases, the court held that you could not just disregard the corporate structure. And what we have here is, if you look at their red brief, they say both inventors assign...
You're complaining about the Western Gecko's control of the documentation, which says to me what I think, which is that this is a question of fact, whether they have ownership of the title is a question of fact, and we review it under that standard. Is that not correct?
Ordinarily so, Your Honor, but here, because the title, the chain of title, is based on contracts, it's a question of law that's reviewed de novo. The inception of the chain of title is testimony, but that testimony doesn't even say who the contract's with. They say it was with Gecko Prakla. There is no Gecko Prakla as a standalone corporation. There are, in their cost-sharing agreements, 7 companies named Gecko Prakla, a UK company, an international company, and various others. There are 9 companies, including a Norwegian company, and this happened in Norway with Mr. Hillison, named Gecko. They don't even know, or they can't even take a position on who the assignment was made to, let alone what the assignment said, let alone what exactly was assigned. And as we've seen in the Stanford versus Roche case,
I don't think
that's
it's
critical.
Clear. They're saying the inventors had testified that they had agreements to assign the patents, and then there's a 1998 agreement and there's a 2000 agreement, which seem to transfer the patents.
Let me address that quickly, because that is something that doesn't transfer the patents, and it doesn't for a few reasons.
Which was doesn't?
Both the 1998 cost sharing and 2000, let me address first, because they're worded almost the same. They almost look like the dupe and revise of each other. In those agreements, drafted under the Internal Revenue Code for some tax sharing purpose, any member of the group can hold legal title, or any other person or nominee can hold legal title to the patent. It doesn't require transfer of legal title to whoever supposedly has the right to the patent. The second thing, Your Honor, is if you look at the termination clause, Schlumberger Limited, the head company in the Netherlands Antilles, they have the right to license anyone at any time without restriction and to terminate any participant. And when they terminate a participant, especially under the 98 agreement, that participant loses all rights that they've been given, if any. At most, that agreement can do some kind of transfer of beneficial interests, but an assignment has to say it's an assignment, it has to transfer ownership, and it has to say who's getting the assignment. And that agreement doesn't say who's going to be the legal title owner. In fact, it says any number of people can be the legal title owner. It says that the person at the top of the chain can license at will and can take away your property or terminate your interest in the property at will. That's not a valid assignment under Section 261. No, Your Honor. I'm saying that under patent law, to have an assignment, it's a transfer of ownership. And one, it's got to be by the patent owner. And so if the patent owner was
they
Geico...
The inventors say they did.
The inventors say that when they started, and the snippets of testimony that are very short, that that was their understanding, or that they signed something to that effect. Mr. Hillison said it was to Geico. Dr. Biddleston said Geico Procla, that's a group of up to 9 corporations. We don't even know who the assignee is. But also, if you recall the Stanford Roche case and other cases, how that assignment is phrased and what's assigned is important. And for example, Mr. Hillison testified that he was supposed to get some kind of bonus depending on how important the patent was. Well, they could have checked their records and at least seen which entity paid them the bonus. You know, they could have seen, at least from the employment records, which entity
hired
them.
Did you ask that question in discovery?
No, Your Honor, because this was first learned after discovery for the reason that Western Geco, on the patents that went to trial, had filed the assignment, but in the cover pages wrote that they were the assignee and the patents issued to Western Geco with the assignee published on the cover page.
So we have a presumption question, too.
No, we don't, Your Honor. And with all due respect, you can really only have one presumption at a time as to who owns it. And under Section 261, the assignment that's of record is presumed to be the owner. And that was in the SIRF case that I believe Judge Dyke also was on. And in we can't have in the same lawsuit, I get a presumption that Schlumberger Technology Company owns it, and they get a presumption that they own it. It's simply because by their own unilateral actions, they caused it to issue that way.
Let's move on to F1 and F2. The jury was properly instructed with respect to F2 on the verdict form. They found infringement under F2. And so quite apart from whether F1 has an intent requirement that wasn't recognized by the district court, in the summary judgment motion or included in the F1 instructions doesn't really make any difference, does it?
I think it does, Your Honor, because this issue of whether the court had already decided that we were an infringer, which was based on the no intent under F1, was something that was hotly disputed, how and when the jury should be informed, and we wanted it to be done in the final instructions and in a way that was clear.
Well, so what's the error?
The error here is that we asked for an instruction. We did ask for it at the conclusion of the F1 instruction that made very clear they could not use the F1 findings and the summary judgment under F1
at
on
all.
F2.
At all.
I can read you the...
I read.
Okay.
It was too broad. The instruction you asked for was too broad because it would have barred them from considering the intent to have the thing assembled abroad.
But what it did make clear, Your Honor, is that even assuming the F1 decision was correct, that we're talking about two different types of intent in the instruction.
Yeah. I mean, if you'd asked for a narrower instruction, you might have an argument. But you asked for an instruction which basically said you can't mention the F1 summary judgment.
I say I'm going into my rebuttal time, but... I think, Your Honor, that looking at the motion in limine, the argument over the instructions as a whole, and the final instruction, it was clear we were just trying to make it so that the jury would see there was no way that they were permitted to use that F1 finding to find F2 liability.
So if we reject that argument, we find that F2 liability... was not infected by the disputes as to the F1 issue, then we can affirm without reaching the F1 issue, right, based on the finding of infringement with respect to F2.
Well, Your Honor, we believe that...
I understand, but hypothetical. We reject your argument that you should have had an instruction that they couldn't consider F1. We reject your argument about the in limine motion. We reject your argument about counsel's argument. If that's all true, then we could sustain the judgment based on the finding of F2 liability without ever reaching F1, right?
Your Honor, I disagree because of the change of the law that the Como opinion affected.
No, I don't think you're answering my question.
You could not, Your Honor, because under F2 or F1, we were entitled to raise invalidity.
What was wrong with the F2 instruction? You didn't object to the F2 instructions, right?
We didn't, but this was a change in the law that came along after.
Well, what should he be instructed on F2 that he didn't?
That he could have considered, and this is reflected in the Federal Circuit model jury instructions that are in use now or available now, that you could consider a good faith belief in invalidity to be a good faith belief of no infringement.
Okay. All right, we'll save your 2 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you.
May it please the Court.
So explain to me how you can get profits under U.S. patent law for profits made abroad.
Sure, Your Honor.
Under power integrations.
Under power integrations, and I think what's an important distinction to start with is power integrations is a 271A case. This is a 271F case. But the question that presents itself in power integrations and in other cases is there an act of infringement? Step one. If there is an act of infringement, then we look at under 284 the harm to the patentee for that act of infringement. And if lost profits can be demonstrated, as they were in this case, they're available. The Congress has determined that for certain areas you can narrow the scope of damages available. I contend that what ION wants to do is say for 271F, we're going to have a narrower scope, and they say as much in their briefs. You have to look at what's going on at the border. What does the component supplier under F make?
Well, let's suppose this weren't a 271F case. It was just a case in which somebody sold a device that was shipped abroad and then used in a way that would infringe if it were in the United States.
Okay.
How can you get
the profits that you would have made from the foreign activity.
You can under 284 in the following scenario. If this was 271A and I had made the entire apparatus here in the United States, or any apparatus, and shipped it abroad, the question becomes, one, is there infringement? Under your hypothetical, yes, under 271A. Then the question is, what's the harm to the patentee under 284? And the harm to the patentee...
What case says you can get foreign profits?
You can get the fact that the impact on the patentee is extraterritorial.
What case says that in my hypothetical about 271A, you can get the foreign profits?
Under 271A, whether you start with right height or you then get to cases that follow on to that say the location of the sale doesn't impact damages. So in Datascope, lost profits were available, but they weren't proven. It's only a royalty that was granted there, but the court said...
What case deals with foreign profits? Says you can get foreign profits.
Happens to be under 271F, there are several. Both in T.D. Williamson, lost profits were granted. In...
Let's stay with 271A. What case says that if you sell something in the United States that's infringing, it's shipped abroad, and the lost profits, you can recover the foreign lost profits? What case says that?
In the Syncor case, infringements under A and B, and they affirmed losses, court affirmed lost profits and a royalty, where the defendants manufactured and sold the bus converters overseas. So the question here is,
were the lost profits in the United States or were they from foreign activity?
The lost profits are to the patentee. Where the sale took place can be abroad. If you under 271A, it's make, use, or sell. Let's just focus on those three. If it's manufactured in the United States and sold in the United States, or it's manufactured in the United States and sold abroad, there's still an active infringement. And under 284, there's nothing that says the harm to the patentee should be reduced. I think you'd agree with me that the harm to the patentee, if I'm the only maker of a product in the United States, in the world, I make it, I have a U.S. patent, and I sell both to U.S. customers and to Canadian customers, and no one else makes it, and then someone in this country makes that product here.
What case under 271A says that if you sell something in the United States that is then used abroad to infringe a method claim that would be infringing if it was in the United States entitles you to lost profits on the use abroad? I mean, I'm not aware of a case.
I'm not aware of a case that describes it in that manner, Your Honor. What I'd say is the cases that deal with foreign, with the use of a product that has already been found infringing for a U.S. act of infringement, they don't distinguish, and if ultimately the act of infringement happens in this country, this court says, and 284 says, you have to look at making the patentee whole, regardless of where the... Let's step back. Your question of what would happen if it was all in the United States versus abroad. If the harm to the patentee, if the acts were solely in the U.S., would be clear. They would lose their profits, and if you could prove them. If they sell some of those units in Canada instead of in the United States, and I was previously selling to those, because let's not forget I have to show but for causation that I lost that sale, why am I not entitled to get those profits, Your Honor? So to be clear, your question of is there a case I can point to that specifically says for the ones that are made in the U.S. under A, but then the customer for those sales was abroad, there actually is one I can think of where I know that's in the damages model, this court in Seaman Tank.
What case discusses that?
No case discusses it in the manner you've asked, Judge Sykes. Okay. Now, but more importantly, I think for this case, 271F was created for a purpose. And the purpose was to make the patentee in no different a situation than if the infringement hadn't happened entirely in the United States. And under 271F, the whole premise is they ship components abroad. And yet, that's an act of infringement under the Patent Act. And if Congress wanted to narrow that and say you have to stop at the border or you don't get lost profits, they could have done so. Under 287, Congress specifically limits damages under 271G. There are also limitations certainly for marketing. And so,
a counterpart patent in France, for example, and the activity were in France, that France could give a remedy for the foreign
activity, right?
In that situation, I think you could choose your remedy, but of course you could never get double compensation or double counting.
Who said?
Well, I'd say it's a policy matter, first off, but there's nothing that suggests you
what
have...
What is it in the U.S. patent law that says you can't get recovery both in France and the United States?
It doesn't say that in the United States patent law. But, so, I'd back up a step. Certainly it's not a patent-only issue. There are cases from the Supreme Court, Birdsell, Glen Eyre goes into this, that you can't get double recovery.
It's an election of remedies.
Correct. And so the idea that that it's, whether it could be done, let's also look at these patents. These are patents that are involved in looking for reservoirs on the high seas. Essentially, you're in no one's country. So it's an apparatus that's shipped from the United States, as Ion does it, abroad. There are U.S. patents that cover that, and they chose to manufacture these components.
Well, where was the contract entered into for the foreign activity?
Well, the question that matters for 271F is the contract to sell the components.
I mean, you say that this happened on the high seas, so it's not subject to anybody else's jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. Where was the contract entered into for the foreign activity?
They're each different depending on who the two sides, the oil company on one side, the surveying company, Ion's customers on the other side, which under 271F, if you supply components to be assembled or you cause them to be supplied, you are an infringer.
No, the contract to perform the services, where were those contracts entered into?
It's not. I don't believe it's in the record, Your Honor. There were multiple jobs shown. They were proven up. This wasn't an argument anyone made, so there wasn't a debate over what law governs the particular contract, Your Honor. With respect to the premise of damages, whether it's reasonable royalty or lost profits, but at base, the proper metric is harm to the plaintiff. There's no argument by Ion that we have not suffered this harm. They went into it knowing indeed exactly what harm we would suffer, not only on the intent side, but specifically identifying the damages we'd suffer. The suggestion we don't compete, we're not entitled to lost profits. The jury heard all this evidence. JA8079 is their business plan. Their business plan specifically says only Western GECO has this technology. We're going to offer this technology. They say we don't have any intention to sell it to any other contractors, ergo we're not going to license. And they say today oil companies have no alternative to their...
Can I turn you to the assignment issue? When were these patents assigned?
These patents were assigned to Western GECO in 2000 as part of the MFA and the TTA, Master Formation Agreement, and Tech Transfer. They were assigned
before. Then why is there an assignment document in the record dated 2001 that's what you submitted in support of ownership to the Patent Office?
For the same reasons that ultimately the District Court found, the 2001 assignment is both a confirmation of prior assignment and an assignment of any future rights. And the language of...
Well, if it would have been a confirmation of an assignment to GECO, or however you say it, you would think that it would have actually assigned it to them, but it didn't. It assigned them to STC. So I understand. So here's my problem with this assignment issue. It seems to me that you have perhaps a valid argument based upon chain of title. If this guy worked for these companies by right of his employment agreement or maybe some assignment in the past, he assigned those prior to this whole merger and everything where all these things were done. That's fine. That's not what you represented to the Patent Office when you filed this patent. What you represented to the Patent Office was that the assignment occurred in 2001 based upon this document. So are you now saying this document isn't the valid assignment, that it's something else?
There is an earlier assignment that the witnesses testified to of their rights. This document is a confirmation of the assignment. It was represented to the Patent Office.
But it's not a confirmation of the assignment because it doesn't reference the same party that you say they were assigned to.
Well, if we step back to the corporate form, and I think to Judge Wallach's point, this is a fact question, and so the judge looked at
that
exact
issue. Are you saying that there's testimony that these were assigned to STC previously and then by operation of this merger that it went to GECO?
The testimony is they were assigned to their employer at the time, GECO Prakla, or Western GECO, which is what it became called, and then there are documents that aren't disputed in the record that have the transfer from
I have a really hard time with this argument. I mean, don't we generally prefer written assignments rather than all of this kind of unsubstantiated testimony?
I agree, and indeed a written assignment is required. It's not a preference.
And we don't have a written assignment documenting what you're saying.
Here's what we have, and I think it's important to understand the context of why this is what we have.
Let me ask you this. If there wasn't a prior assignment, mm-hmm. if this is the assignment, this assignment is to STC.
Correct.
Then all that previous corporate merger doesn't matter. That happened before this assignment to STC. So STC is the owner of the patents if we read this as the valid legal assignment.
I don't agree. I think, obviously, you understand my view and that there's an assignment before that, but to your hypothetical, if that's the only assignment and there was no other, then the situation at hand would be, were there the prior agreements? In those agreements, did STC assign its rights at the time or in existence? And the language of the transfer to Western GECO from STC, this is the TTA as well as the MFA, and I'll note, I want to get back to it in a second, but the MFA, the Master Foreign Engineering 2000, lists this patent. Okay? It actually lists this family of patents on it.
Okay, but that's the problem. If that patent was assigned previously,
yes.
then Dr. Biddleston had no property to assign in 2001. So that's another variant of saying that this 2001 document really isn't the effective assignment. But that's the problem. If we look at this as the effective document, I don't understand how any of that prior stuff relates to this document.
Because the tech transfer agreement and the CSA refer to any rights that are obtained or any rights in existence at the time. One says anything in existence, and one says any rights that are obtained. And so in the event that that was the scenario, and the district court judge looked at this also, because he heard this argument, and he said, I don't give it any weight. I've looked at the evidence. He looked at that evidence, which under Sanofi is not a question of law, de novo. It still gets deference. So the district court judge, he said, I've looked at that, and it transfers anything they get their hands on. So that would cover it, even if it only came to them in 2001. The tech transfer agreement says anything in existence, and there's no debate, the rights were in existence. It had been invented already, first off. And under the cost-sharing agreement, it would be because anything that they ultimately get in that space, and there's no debate it's in that space, was transferred. So it can be a transfer of anything I get. It's no different than an employee agreement. If I invent it later...
So you're saying these prior cost-sharing agreements and the like said any kind of patent rights you have now or you obtain in the future are owned by Western Gecko?
The cost-sharing agreement 2000 says any rights which are obtained. Okay. The tech transfer agreement says any IP in existence at the time. It doesn't matter who owns it.
Right, but that latter sentence can't be a transfer of this, or it would render this document ineffective, because if the IP was in existence at the time,
mm-hmm.
and it was owned by one of those companies and transferred to Western Gecko, then it wasn't owned by Dr. Biddleston. So he didn't have the authority to reassign it in 2001. Do you see what I'm getting at?
I do see what you're saying, because you're saying it becomes a circular argument.
It's inconsistent.
Well, it's completely inconsistent.
The 2001 assignment relates to, it's at some level, it's probably a belt and suspenders exercise, but the context of why we have these agreements and no testimony...
But it seems to assume that the inventors still owned it, right?
Although if you read the actual agreement, it says, I have done so, or I will do so. It's referring to actions he has already taken, or the desire is, the actual language of it says...
But he never made an assignment to Western Gecko.
He did, his employment agreement, and he testified to this. He had assigned, as of the nature of his employment, for GECO Prakla. Both of these individuals worked for
him. But again, if that's the case,
yes.
then this is not the valid document. If that's the case, this document is completely unnecessary.
I agree. It is unnecessary, and your question is...
But that's the problem. You're asking us to ignore this document when this is the very document you submitted to the Patent Office to show ownership. You didn't submit this title of chain of title argument to the Patent Office to show ownership.
I'm not saying...
You would be on much firmer ground if you hadn't created this document, which I said seems to be probably an attempt to shore up what may have been a weak chain of title argument.
Except this is not a situation where it's a nunk-pro-tunk assignment right before you file suit. This is years earlier in the course of a merger arrangement. There's no question that this is all one entity. This is not a case where you have, does he own it over here or does he own it over here? This is a corporate chain of events. And the language of the assignment you're pointing to says, this is J.A.
Right, I've read it.
Okay, it says, they're desirous of confirming their ownership.
It also says that he warrants that he has the right to make the assignment. And if he had already given it away, he didn't have the right to make that assignment.
Can I make one more point on this, which is I think it's important to remember the context of why we're here and how we're in this situation. This was pled and never disputed that these patents were owned by Western GECO. The witnesses were deposed, and they testified that they had assigned it to their employer. And their argument at base is there's no best evidence. You don't have the best evidence.
But their employer was not Western GECO.
Their employer was GECO Prakla.
Which was a predecessor in interest.
It is a predecessor. And the agreement in 1998 that the judge found when he looked at this, transferred it to STC, is from GECO Prakla, Your Honor. So their employer was GECO Prakla. There's no dispute about the testimony. It wasn't objected to. And the fact of the matter is if they had...
So the idea is that the 2001 assignment is saying we earlier assigned this to a predecessor corporation of Western GECO?
It is, because at the time, Your Honor, it was GECO Prakla, then it was Schlumberger Technology Corporation. And there
but it doesn't
chain
read that way, though, right?
It reads that STC is desirous of confirming its ownership of those rights. And it had those rights. And so to Judge Hughes' point...
Okay, so STC just confirmed its rights in 2001 that it owns the patent.
That it had been given, it had been given those rights. And by everyone's agreement, there are multiple tech transfers from STC to
Western GECO. I don't understand how what you meant was to reconfirm that Western GECO was the owner of the patent, which is what you put on the face of the patent application. This assignment didn't say Western GECO had them.
Here's the rub to your question, which is if this issue had been presented in any form or fashion,
well, I understand
we
that,
could have gone into these, but we didn't have the ability to post-trial.
But, you know, standing can be raised at any time.
It can, but you can. This court and the Supreme Court said you can stipulate to facts and you can admit facts that ultimately control that decision. They did, but as another matter, Ajinomoto is a case in this court where the original transfer from the inventor doesn't exist. No one has it. But everyone knows they worked for the entity. And there was no dispute as to the law at the time that you could have an agreement like that with your employer. And it was ultimately found on a record that there was no dispute that they worked there at the time. And the testimony came in unobjected to and unrebutted as to who their owner is. So there's no best evidence argument. So I contend that at worst, on the standing issue, it would be an issue that should be resolved factually. The district court judge did that. He was presented, if they wanted other evidence or other discovery, the court said, I've looked at your argument, I've looked at yours, I've looked at the witness testimony, I've looked at all the agreements and the underlying interplay
between
them.
But he didn't address this inconsistency, did he?
He did. The judge specifically addressed the argument of the 2001 assignment in his decision. It's JA 6 and 7 and 8. And he looked at this issue and he said, there's the cost-sharing agreement which would have assigned the rights they obtained.
Okay. I think we're out of time.
Okay. It's a question of whether or not it's clear error. It's not. We think it should be affirmed.
Mr. Healing?
Your Honor, I'd just like to say two things about each of these points. First of all, to follow up on the assignment does not mention Western GECO anywhere.
Can you go back to the prejudice issue on the F2 versus the F1? Because it seems to me let's assume that the F1 instruction in the summary judgment was wrong because it didn't require some kind of intent. Explain to me again what the standard is for determining prejudice and why it's met here, because you seem to concede that the jury was properly instructed on how to find infringement under F2.
The prejudice, Your Honor, first of all, is the natural prejudice that any trial lawyer has experienced if the judge is telling the jury and the other side's allowed to tell the jury from the beginning to the end that they've been already found to be an infringer. That's as damning as saying someone's already been convicted of one of the offenses they're charged with. So you've got that prejudice. Putting that aside, though, you've also got the prejudice that you're doing the same product, same transaction, same party, same invoices, and they're not being told to keep these things separate. And the normal inclination of any layperson is if you're dealing with two things that are the same, you're going to treat them the same. And we tried to prevent that from happening at multiple stages. Western GECO opposed it at every stage. If I can talk just couple of quick things about each of the assignment and the lost profits.
What are we supposed to do if we do conclude that there's an inconsistency between the 2001 purported assignment and this alleged chain of title? What are we supposed to do about that?
You would dismiss the case as to the Biddleston patents.
Well, can we send it back? Because it seems to me that the record is not sufficiently developed on this point. You raised it really late. And obviously you can raise it at any point in the proceedings, but it certainly was raised really late. And it does seem that there are inconsistent theories here. But why wouldn't the better course to be, given that you raised it so late, to allow discovery or at least some kind of further argument on standing?
There's two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, the best interpretation of what the parties considered the document to be is how they treated it. And STC used this document, not Western Geco, STC, to file the original patent in their name, prosecute it in their name, fill out the cover pages in the records of the patent office in their name, and to this day, the database in the patent office shows that the parent patent is owned by STC. That shows they didn't intend that Western Geco owned this patent at the time of this assignment. And the assignment itself says that the inventors are assigning it free and clear. That's, you know, an attestation that this is a going forward assignment. The second thing, Your Honor, is there's no need to remand for this because Dr. Biddleston, who signed this, he's a senior executive with these people. They could have just put in a declaration in response to our motions and said, this is what happened, this is what I understood, I did sign something, and they could have gotten some records to show who owned it. The PCT application that Mr. LoCascio refers to is actually assigned to GECO AS, a Norwegian company, not GECO Procla. And that is in our brief, and it's also, if you look at JA 01349, well, you'll see, actually, if you look at JA 13149, you'll see that this was prosecuted by Schlumberger Technology Company, but the PTC application, you'll see, was first signed to Gecko AS and then other Gecko companies, but never to Gecko Procla. Just as Mr. Hillison never testified he worked for Gecko Procla. He said he worked for Gecko, which I'm assuming, since he worked in Norway, it was probably Gecko AS, but I don't know. There's nine companies that have the word Gecko in the title, and they're all separate entities. The final thing, if I may, and I know I'm over my time, if I could have another moment, just to comment
just
on the
one loss, moment, quickly.
On the lost profits, there is no case that says you can get damages for exploiting a U.S. patented invention outside of the U.S. for use of that. That has been the law in the U.S. for over 150 years since the Brown case in 1857, which was reaffirmed in Microsoft. Power Integrations rejected this exact argument. And here, if they had been saying we made something overseas with these components, that somehow they were entitled to leapfrog from components to made, I don't know what would have happened. But their damages were for our customers' use of surveys.
I think we're about out of time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate your time.
And since the cross appeal wasn't addressed, there's no further rebuttal argument. So the case is submitted. We thank both counsel.